The time is now exactly 11:30. Coming up next, You and Your Money.
We may not have a cent to pay the rent, but we're gonna make it. I know we will.
Good morning. This is Susan Lee. Welcome to You and Your Money, the program for financial balance and financial health. Little Milton, who is the theme person, is the same person who sang the theme. We are going to make it. We have to make it, though, at Pacifica, as well as on an individual level. So today's program is going to be about financial health and financial balance. This is going to be a bylaws half hour, but a different spin on the bylaws. Let me just make sure one of our guests is there. David Moore, are you on the phone?
Yes.
Terrific. As many of you know, David Moore is the son of Lou Hill, the founder of the Pacifica Foundation, to whom we are all quite indebted. And my other guest for the day is Harvey Epstein. Welcome to WBAI, Harvey.
Thank you. Good morning.
So I got a telephone call this weekend from somebody I'd been in a progressive women's group with 30 years ago. And she said, you know, when you got this sort of interest, she was talking about my interest in money, she said, I thought it was deviant. Now, she no longer believed her parents who said, you don't need a checkbook, you don't need to save money. How is this related to bylaws? Well, we're so busy at bylaws meetings fighting the last battle, which is to keep out people who were intent on just going against our mission, that what we have forgotten is that we're running a corporation that has more than $12 million of income, that has staffs, that has contracts to negotiate. And so what I'm concerned about is not only people who are malevolent, but people who may, with all good intentions, not know how to be on a board. They may not know how to run a corporation. I think being money challenged is a thing that is very typical on the left. So today's show is going to be about fiduciary responsibility. It's going to be about what can we do to do the best we can to make sure our folks are competent and have integrity. Harvey is an attorney with the Community Law Office, and that is a group that part of Legal Aid helps nonprofits on the Upper West Side. Let me give you his phone number. If you need Harvey, you're on the Upper West Side, call 212-426-3000. Harvey, what's fiduciary responsibility?
I just want to correct one quick thing. It's all for all of Upper Manhattan. So people who are living on the east side above 96th Street, on the west side above 110th Street, our office services the entire Upper Manhattan neighborhood. In reference to fiduciary responsibilities, it's really talking about three issues. The focus is the duty of care, loyalty, and obedience. And for duty of care, it's very simple. People who are on boards have to take responsibility of being on the board. That means they have to attend their meetings, they have to review the documents, they have to act as what's called a reasonably prudent person standard. They have to respond in very specific ways to things that are going on in the board.
So in other words, that means if you're given a contract to vote on, you have to read it.
That's a very simple thing to do. Any person would think before you vote on something, you have to read the contents of what you're voting on. That's a very simple thing that they do. I mean, the other duty of loyalty, it makes sense. What a duty of loyalty is, your loyalty is to the corporation above everything else. And as we all see in not-for-profit organizations, people get involved in these organizations not because of the money or because of the corporation, because they believe in the mission of the organization. So it's the loyalty to the mission above all else. And then the duty of the obedience. Means obedience to the mission and the purpose of the organization, to its mission, its founding, its statements. And in many ways, what we experience at Legal Aid is, especially with people who are starting out for profits, they really don't know how to run organizations. They don't know how to run corporations. What they've been is activists or organizers or involved in a specific issue. But when it comes to the financial pieces or the legal pieces or fundraising, they really don't have the skills. And that's something that we try to help them with training, educational materials.
Well, then let's start with the training. You have school for nonprofits, Would you describe the training which I would like to institute as part of any system we have?
Well, I mean, the board itself of a nonprofit organization, before they put people on the board, mm-hmm. should really take some specific steps to train people on what their obligations and responsibilities will be on the board. And in many ways, when you're being put on a board, you don't really think about those issues, and the people who are on the board aren't looking for people who have those skills. So, you know, the training that the not-for-profit itself gets set up, there are organizations on the outside, like my organization or Lawyers Alliance or other organizations that are out there, which specifically do training for not-for-profit organizations to teach them the tools that they need to be able to effectively and efficiently manage their organization.
And you're finding that this notches up people's awareness so that...
Yeah, I mean, it notches up their awareness, but more, you know, it enhances their skill and their ability to better function in the organization. If you don't have these skills, or people in your organization do not have these skills, you are going to fall into problems, whether it's failure to report whatever you're supposed to report, organizations are getting problems with taxes because they're an employer now, and they don't realize they have to deal with employment taxes as small organizations. They don't understand their requirement of filings. They don't understand what they're required to do with their members or their donors, or they don't understand how to review contracts because they haven't seen contracts before, mm-hmm. or what a contract should say. So there are all these pitfalls that board members can fall into because for a lot of realistic reasons, they haven't had these experiences in their lives before. But before they walk into that responsibility, they really need to get, or while they're engaged, they need to get the training.
So I think that's great because I think education is the first step for everybody. And what you can't do anything about are the people who know it all before they walk in, as Sharan says. If you know it all, you can't learn anything. So we have to inculcate that into our system, that this training is part of it. At least I believe we do. Now, let me just say that the problems we're bringing up today are not limited to nonprofits. I just want to read to you a survey that I picked out of the Times that 60% of 225 executives from Fortune 1000 companies don't think that the people on their boards have the financial savvy either. So I'm not just picking on our folks here. It's a problem. Okay. There's something Harvey and I were talking about last night, conflict of interest policies. It's something we can perhaps put in the bylaws.
Yeah. What we really recommend is each not-for-profit board have a conflict of interest policy. A lot of these organizations don't, and because it's not something that's come up or they don't expect that there's going to be a conflict of interest, but we encourage them from the beginning to draft conflict of interest policies, deal with interested and disinterested directors, and understand whether people have some benefit in relation to something that the board's doing.
Okay, give some examples. Let me give you an example where we had many of us who spent last year demonstrating. We had a few good examples where we believed that the people who were on the board wanted to sell the station and somehow get a cut of that sale. Now, how is that a conflict of interest?
Well, again, we go back to the duties that the directors or the people who are on the board have. And the duty of loyalty is loyalty to the corporation above all else. So it's above your own personal gain. So if you are engaging in a contract on behalf of the corporation, if you have any direct or indirect gain from that contract, then your loyalty then isn't beholden to the corporation. It ends up being beholden to yourself because you're going to get some kind of financial benefit. And under a conflict of interest policy, anyone who has a direct or indirect conflict is obligated to abstain from voting on those contracts.
So what happens to you if you break the conflict of interest policy?
Well, depending on the organization, the membership of the organization can commence a lawsuit against the organization. The attorney general can come in and invalidate the contract, which has happened before. And in many cases, these are small contracts, so the organization may try to skirt by, but it really is a breach, and there can be individual liability against the directors.
So in other words, if we put one of these things in and we were taken over, and this is California, it's not New York, so the laws may not be exactly
sure.
The same. There's a question of standing, and a contract was signed where there was a direct conflict of interest. That would mean somebody would be able to intervene, perhaps, if our board was not the board that we needed.
Well, someone would have to have standing to commence a lawsuit, and depending on the corporate structure of the not-for-profit corporation, some people may or may not have standing, but directors definitely would have standing, and the people who voted against the contract would, or people saying that other directors should not vote because they're interested parties.
Right.
But yeah, I think conflict of interest policies can really alleviate those problems, because once you have a policy, you have to follow it. If you don't engage in a policy, it really could allow for corruption within the corporation.
Right. So thank you. This is really a good beginning. It's not a total solution. Now David will come in with some of his ideas about how we can protect internally. David, do you want to talk about how elections would help us?
Sure. Let me get at that from a little bit larger context. I really think that in terms of fiscal integrity and competence, that Pacifica's mission adds an additional layer of requirement for clarity and accountability. They're maybe unique in communications media, because not only does the math have to add up, and not only is there no room for conflict of interest, and it's really fascinating to hear Harvey clarify these processes, and I would agree they need to go into the bylaws where appropriate. But because of the public trust of the network, because of the investments of the community and the community radio, there's an additional openness, I think, required of Pacifica staff and management. And I think in this bylaws discussion, this year of revision, there's some interesting conversations going on about levels of financial transparency, and I really think that in a community radio, that's an additional energy of expectation and requirement on the directors and the staff. And in terms of your question of elections as one of the internal ways of fostering and ensuring and maintaining such transparency and openness, I think the process of democratizing the network that's also going on this year is raising the crucial questions about election and recall and grievance of folks in positions of power within the network who would have to be accountable to that national constituency. And towards this process, I think we could also, in the bylaws revision discussion, include a code of ethics, which I've talked about elsewhere, which certainly would have fiscal and fiduciary accountability as part of the code. And perhaps in the democratization of the network, we can set up a review process around the mission and a code of ethics built on that mission that has to do with keeping accountability.
Let me just say, David, I'm not sure if we're going to have time to take telephone calls. 212-209-2900. If we have time, we'll take them. 212-209-2900. So, David, could you explain, although I think it may be obvious, why recall is such an integral part of this democratization process?
Yeah. Again, I'd like to take it from a larger context, that everything has to do with the mission. And if there are behaviors within the organization that don't fit the mission, we need ways of fixing that. Now, I think within the Pacifica context, the very notion of dialogue sets up perhaps another layer in a structure of recall, which would include dialogue with the offenders rather than immediate sanction. I'm thinking of the Navajo Peace Courts, where mediation rather than advocacy and adversarial approaches becomes a community builder in a justice system.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be an interesting conversation to have. But clearly, however that recall structure is developed, that's there perhaps with ombudsmen or ombudspersons and grievance procedures, plus the longer cycles of election and re-election.
Wait, David, let me just give the number again in case we have time. 212-209-2900. And also let me just say, for folks who want to know more about the bylaws, there's going to be a two-hour discussion of a much a broader scope of than what we're discussing today. Tomorrow, I believe, from 1 to 3. And if you want to find out about the bylaws, you can go on WBAI.net, which is just put together by Roger Manning, and it's terrific, or Pacifica.org. Thanks, Pete Caracas, for doing your work on that. So also the other thing, David, by the way, you and I have been talking about the need for an ombudsperson. Carol Spooner just posted two drafts that we will be considering for the bylaws, and an ombudsperson is in her draft, although it does not necessarily have a major stress on fiduciary stuff, but it's in there.
Yeah, I was trying to get a hold of those bylaws yesterday, and they weren't up on
WBAI.net. You can, if anyone's interested, it's WBAI.net for this.
I think it's worth saying that the democratization process, and I might be stumbling over that word because of the very problems associated with it. It's always messy, and as James Madison says, no form of government can be a perfect guard against the abuse of power, but democracy and the efforts of the community ethos to be expressed through democracy, I think, is where we're moving, and that's always an ongoing process. But I'd like to, I guess, reemphasize that the mission of Pacifica is unique among communications media in that it's stated to actually improve communication toward understanding and resolving causes of human conflict in the world.
And something you said interested me. You used the word offenders. I myself like to prevent. It's sort of like my show is about health and how do you keep health. I want the impossible, I suppose. But what I think we're trying to do here today, Harvey, if you agree, is to try to prevent problems. It's my own sense is everyone, or almost everyone who's involved in this Pacifica movement is very well intended, and mistakes happen. I know I make them every day, and I have to find them the next morning. So that the trick, for instance, here's something, Harvey, and I wonder if you would agree with this. My sense of this is that there has to be focus on putting in rules and procedures on how the nonprofit is run, for instance, in negotiating a contract. It's not just going in and saying, hey ho. It's laying out criteria. It's having processes for all this. Now, how does a nonprofit do this?
I think that's right. I think there's a couple ways not-for-profits can do it. They can put in a process, well, let's say a competitive bidding process for specific contracts that they're engaging in to make sure there's a variety of people who apply for the same position or for the same contract for the same whatever you're working on. Pacifica might be a different scenario. And then there's an oversight, whether it's an advisory board or a membership structure that's in place that says we're watching the board to make sure they're actually doing what they said they're going to do.
So there's never one person just doing stuff.
Right, and that's the biggest problem with not-for-profits. Mm-hmm. It becomes a one-person show or a two- or three-person mm-hmm. show. And when it becomes mm-hmm. that, it really becomes their individual mission and desires instead of the desires of the larger organization.
And that speaks to David's openness, where there has to be committees, there has to be openness. So how do you, in a deal like we've got, which is all across the country, I mean, I've gotten to know David because of national boards, how do you run an operation where, say, you've got a contract or you want to pick an attorney? How does a board that spreads across the country pick an attorney?
Well, I think it's really easy with our technology now. I mean, we can have teleconferences. We can have electronic discussions of documents. People can make changes to whatever document they want in the same minute that someone else is making changes to the same document because of the capacity via the Internet, via video conferencing. I mean, all that is possible. You don't have to be physically in the same room to do that. You can interview someone, or you know, you can have the whole board interviewing the same attorneys. The attorneys in Europe, but the boards in California, that interview can still happen.
And you would interview three or four so that there wouldn't be somebody's accountant was chosen or somebody's attorney was chosen.
Exactly.
And nobody. So it's the openness, David, that Harvey's pushing.
The other thing is, I mean, we have to recognize that people talk to people and have relationships. So, I mean, people are going to ask people to do something because they know them. So it's the broader network. If one person is doing it, it's their network.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a board of six or seven and they're doing it, then it's a broader network of individuals, and you have a broader breadth of people you're going to be engaging with. And the more open it is, and the more people you engage in the process, the more likely it's going to look less disinterested.
I have a question for both of you, which is the one, you know. Our folks do not have MBAs in nonprofit administration. And I understand all this openness, but how do you convince somebody of the necessity for attention to this kind of focus? So either one of you or both of you, how do you do it?
You first, Harvey.
Thanks, David. Well, what I always encourage people to do is understand the depth of responsibility of the job being on a board. It isn't just, oh, you're getting appointed to the board so you can be on the name and be on the letterhead and donate some money or whatever you do. It's a lot more responsibility that goes along with that. And people really need to understand that responsibility before they engage on the board. And it means really doing your homework before you go there. It means understanding what the organization does, looking at the financial of the organization, understanding the contracts that they're engaged in, understanding the responsibility that it has, so then you can better perform your job. Because if you can't do those things, then you're of no benefit to the organization.
So am I hearing that you might even be suggesting, not certainly as a bylaw, but you might be suggesting some sort of training for candidates so that they know what they're getting into?
I mean, that exists in other structures, like for the low-income cooperative structure.
Mm-hmm.
For tenants who are running their own buildings as low-income cooperatives, there's a training obligation for board members. I think that's a good responsibility. Some boards actually have ongoing responsibilities for training, management, supervision.
Well, I want to do it before. Mm-hmm. I want to do it. Nominees, so
right.
That they have to literally know what responsibility they're running for.
Some of the problems that we have is getting good people on board.
Oh.
And we all experience that same problem. There's a small pool of people that you're looking to try to get on your board, mm-hmm. and they're being pulled in 20 different directions. But at the same time, like you said, if there's services that are available to help people along the way, you can make the pool larger. It may be the commitment might be before they get on the board. It might be the commitment after they get on the board to reach out to the agencies that are available, the resources that are available, go to the Attorney General's website, look at the sources that they have. They have a lot of material available to them, the New York State Attorney General, on obligations and responsibilities of being a board member and your fiduciary responsibilities. People should read that information. That should be handed out to people who are on boards.
Mm-hmm.
They should really get that understanding. And a lot of times they just don't. They just say they're on the board, they don't look at the information, and they're lucky if they attend the meetings. And then it's all over.
Exactly. David?
Harvey, what you're outlining there is a process. You know, we'll have hurdles and pools and eddies where there'll be a sense of the need for training at this point, the need to develop the pool that's available, the sense that we don't have an adequate pool, we have to do the best with what we have, and that process is institution building. It's building the governance of a national network, and I think it's worth also keeping in mind that the communications that lubricates that process has to be highlighted at every step of the way, and that in fact we can include in the institutionalization of Pacifica, we can include a set of structures which involve fostering that communication, both as boards rather than individuals running events that generate precisely the networking that you're describing as a larger and larger set of resources to build what's obviously a difficult process of board management.
David, I really want to thank you very much for joining us today. This has been David Moore and Harvey Epstein. And let me give Harvey's telephone number. David, I'll give yours if you want, but I think I should give Harvey's.
My 11-year-old might have a hard time fielding those calls, yeah.
Harvey Epstein, Community Law Center, Upper Manhattan, nonprofit issues. 212-426-3000. And by the way, folks, Legal Aid has groups of folks to deal with nonprofit issues all around the city of New York. So call Legal Aid or even Harvey's office if you're not in Upper Manhattan, so you can get help with this so that we can make sure that our organizations are well taken care of. Next week, we will be having a personal finance, you and your money. I thank you very much, Harvey, for coming and joining us. Take care, David. We will speak.
Thanks so much.
Have a great week of financial health and financial balance.
We may not have a cent to pay the rent, but we're gonna make.
And You and Your Money was brought to you live. This is WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM. Coming up at 1 o'clock will be Natural Living with Gary Null, but here is the WBAI Community Bulletin Board.
Kabuya! The following is a list of events from the WBAI Community Bulletin Board. On Saturday, August 17th, in commemoration of the 115th birthday of Marcus Mosiah Garvey, get on the bus and join the millions for reparations at the National Rally in Washington, D.C. For bus locations, ticket, and general information, call 718-398-1766. That's 718-398-1766.
The Church of the Master invites you to a health fair and jazzmobile concert on Saturday, July 27th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Admission is free. The health fair will be held at the church, which is located at 86 Morningside Avenue and West 122nd Street, and will include health and dental examinations along with healthy snacks. The jazzmobile is expected to appear at 2 p.m. For more information, call 212-517-1599. That's 212-517-1599.
Did you know that more people suffer from Parkinson's disease than multiple sclerosis, muscular dystrophy, and Lou Gehrig's disease combined? Did you know that Parkinson's disease can affect people of all ages? In fact, the number of people in their 30s and 40s is rising at an alarming rate. While there isn't yet a cure, there is hope. If you think you or someone you love may have Parkinson's disease, call now to get help. Call 1-800-223-2732. That's 1-800-223-2732.
Turn out for Festival Esperanza, an all-day celebration to benefit Project OI, a community educational program for children in New York and Mexico. The festival will take place from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. on Saturday, July 27th, at the Clemente Soto Velez Cultural Center, 107 Suffolk Street, between Delancey and Rivington, near the F train, in Manhattan's Lower East Side. There'll be children's activities early in the day, followed by videos, art, refreshments, poetry from El Barrio, performances including music from Tribu and Yerba Buena, and an open jam session with a politically suspect string band. For more information, call 212-665-0174. That's 212-665-0174.
New York City Housing Preservation Development invites Brooklyn residential property owners to learn about free program services. The event will be held in the auditorium at PS 269, located at 1957 Nostrand Avenue, between Foster and Farragut Avenues. Owners interested in attending the event should call no later than Thursday, July 25th to register. Contact Owner Services Program at 212-863-5300. That's 212-863-5300.
Are you interested in starting a business? Do you have a business that you would like to expand? The Small Business Development Center at Baruch College is ready to assist you in obtaining financing. It also provides business counseling and offers seminars in accounting, marketing, management, law, and other business topics. And all of these services are free. To become a client, Call the Baruch College Small Business Development Center at 646-312-4790. That's 646-312-4790.
Let us know what's going on in your community. Write to us at least 2 weeks in advance at WBAI, 120 Wall Street, 10th floor.